Welcome to the Cabin Culture Podcast, where we spend a little more time diving deeper into all the fun parts of cabin culture. I like to think of this as both the material and imagined expressions of how cabin lovers, dwellers, builders, and designers wish to live a more simple and authentic life. On today's episode, we're talking to Boris and Susan, the couple behind Lumen Camps, located in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. It's a tale of leaving the familiar behind, embracing the unknown, and transforming a passion for travel into a thriving entrepreneurial journey. We'll uncover how a simple honeymoon could turn into a life-altering adventure, and how our guests leverage their corporate experiences to forge new opportunities in the world of hospitality and real estate with their newest venture, Lumen Camps. After purchasing an old family-run campground, they decided to up it a notch with glamping tents, then cabins, and the nicest campground bathrooms I've ever seen in my life. As entrepreneurs and real estate investors prior to Lumen Camps, they offer fascinating insight on scaling operations and creating systems that ensure efficiency, high-end guest experience, and some personal sanity. So join me as we chat with Boris and Susan and learn how the roads less traveled can sometimes lead to the best destinations. Let's do it. Can you start by giving the people a little bit of an overview of what brought you to where you are right now?
Yeah, so it's a lot to unpack here, but you know, we oftentimes like to say that where we are right now and where we kind of ended up with Lumen in particular was a result of a honeymoon trip that we took about six years ago. Basically, around the time that we got married, we decided to put our jobs on hold. And we bought a 20-year-old Land Cruiser, put a rooftop tent on top of the vehicle, and did a road trip from Boston to Argentina.
Yeah. Susan, I heard from reading that this was your idea.
That's kind of true. Like I had this random idea many years before a very, very like far away idea. But then in 2017, we just decided. So before the trip, I used to work at a high-tech company for almost 10 years, and Boris was the entrepreneur, always working on his own projects. But after that, we decided that we think we wanted to have a pause of our career and restart somewhere. And then this idea popped up again, and then we think maybe it's time to execute on it.
Yeah. And it feels like this is a thing that we're seeing a lot more of now. There's tons of Instagram accounts and YouTube channels and like travel influencers. But I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like in 2017, it wasn't as much of, like, there were some people buying around the world tickets and traveling and things like that, but it wasn't nearly as popular as it is now. Is that true?
Possibly. I don't think for us it was ever about kind of Instagram or doing the influencer thing at that particular time. It was just something that effectively called out to us. It's something that we really wanted to do. We talked about a lot. And the timing never is quite right to take 7 months off and go do something like that.
Yeah.
But we decided that it would be a nice way to celebrate our marriage and off we went.
That's one hell of a honeymoon, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a very long honeymoon.
Yeah. Okay, so in all those travels, I have to ask, and I'm sure this is probably like the number one most asked question, but of all the places that you went, where's the number one place that you would tell folks to go?
It's a tough question because, to be frank, a lot of places along the ways were great. And we can talk about any individual destination, but I think that what was really most memorable about that trip was just the feeling that we had, which is kind of a feeling of the complete and total freedom. And the camping part of it was actually a big part of it. Because we were self-contained, we had, again, a tent, we had a little kitchen, we could pretty much park our truck anywhere along the route and spend the night and kind of have that flexibility. That's what I think was really memorable. A lot of the times that we spent camping.
And it's very interesting that we actually didn't spend a lot of time in big cities. Of course, we stopped by big cities to like check out like famous places. But majority of the times we actually just stopped by a random village and just park there and enjoy the nature, enjoy the local people and local culture, which is a very memorable part for us. Yeah.
Did you find that people, because, and I don't know which languages you might speak or not speak, as someone who's primarily an English-speaking person traveling all the way through South America, did you find that people were generally pretty receptive of you showing up in a truck and just like throwing up a tent and like camping places? Or were there a lot of questions?
Yeah, there are definitely moments like we probably pop up a tent in the middle of the village, and in the morning when we pop our head out and we saw people just like so curiously like checking out what we were doing there in the middle of the village. But most times, like, people are super friendly, so we never come across anything we don't feel comfortable about.
Yeah.
In the very beginning of the trip, we spent about a week in a small town in Mexico just doing an intense Spanish course. And
it's a good idea.
It was, I mean, it was obviously the bare minimum, but it helped. It helped a lot along the way. And then I think we became very fluent in different, how to say different car parts in Mexico as a way to point out what was broken at any given time.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like you both, I know doing some of my research, and Susan, you just mentioned that you have a background in tech. Boris, what is your background before you got into hospitality and real estate, which is what we'll spend most of our time talking about? What brought you to that space?
My background is in entrepreneurship and e-commerce in particular. Over the last 15 years, I've had a couple of different companies. Some of them were sold. Some of them I still run, including an electric bike company that I started about 12 years ago and still operate. So starting a new business was always something that was very familiar to me. Operating a business was, again, something that was always maybe my strength as well. And then when it came to hospitality in particular, I think the entry point to it was really just home ownership and real estate. And it's something that Susan and I talked about many times when we first met. And we've always wanted to own our own place. And in the beginning, we got involved with Airbnb as a way to really kind of start to pay for it, and I really loved it. And everything,
I mean,
it
actually started all like right before our trip in 2017. We purchased our first home, and then we decided that we're going to make it an Airbnb and start running it and see how it goes. And
is this while you were traveling? So you decided to take off and you Airbnb'd it?
Yeah, we kind of like, so we started the first Airbnb and we set it up and started running it, and then we left for the trip. And then during our 7 months abroad, we figured it's actually totally doable to actually run remotely. So it just makes perfect sense for us. So after we came back from our trip, we're just thinking, oh, maybe we can do more. And while we were doing our job, maybe we can do something else and something more real estate. And then it just gradually like evolving to something we're having right now.
Okay. I'm always curious about early adopters of Airbnb. And I know 2010 isn't like, it is pretty early in their journey though, but I'm guessing you both are, it sounds like, connected to like the startup tech world. Is that how you found out about Airbnb, or what was your first entry point?
Well, Airbnb in general, I mean, it was making the news pretty much since day one. Actually, one of the reasons why I moved to Boston many years ago was to help start a person-to-person car sharing company, which was interesting because it was a similar concept as Airbnb, but applied to vehicles. So we were always involved in that space. But it really did take us a while before we decided to participate in Airbnb as hosts. It wasn't until, I would say, 2017 that we did our first property.
Oh, I thought it was in 2010.
2017. Yeah.
Okay. Because 2010 was like very early. And I feel like it did make the news a little bit, but it took a while for it to like move outside of the tech space, where like folks in that space, because they had gone to Y Combinator, right? So if like anyone running a startup tended to know about Airbnb, but outside of that bubble, I found that not as many people knew about it. And then to make the jump into actually not traveling with it, but hosting, felt like an even bigger jump.
It's funny because I still have an email that I sent to Brian Chesky just on a whim in around 2010 when they were just starting up. And I basically said, wow, you know, great idea. Can I invest $20,000 into it? And he sent back a response basically saying, thank you, but, you know, we're all set for now.
And
I can't tell you how many times I wish that I would be a little bit more persistent at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, for anyone who doesn't know, Brian Chesky is the CEO of Airbnb. But yeah, that was like right when they were starting, because I went through the sister accelerator, Imagine K-12, which was like the ed tech version of Y Combinator. And I swear our investors had also been investors in Airbnb. And every single example of how to run a startup, it would always be like, okay, let me tell you about the founders of Airbnb. And that's when I was like, okay. And I came back from San Francisco and was like, maybe I should check out Airbnb. I guess I'll throw my guest room up on this thing. They seem to love what they're doing. But it was like very much, I only knew about it really at that point because of the startup world where everyone was talking about it. But outside of that, it felt like it took longer.
That's true.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Okay. So you have a background in business, which I think is really interesting. When you did enter the short-term rental space, it seems like, and maybe this is just, here we are 7 years later, I'm looking at your website, you have quite a portfolio of not just Lumen Camps, but also other properties, it looks like. And so did you enter it with the mindset, like, how could you not? If you're an entrepreneur, you must have entered it with the mindset of like, what can we grow this into? How did it start? And like, what was the vision when you first started?
I think to be honest, with the very first and maybe second property, I don't think we had any grand vision at that particular time. It's just something that we always thought that real estate was interesting. We always, we like to travel. So we like hospitality as well as users. And we were interested in kind of seeing the other side of it. But the first couple of properties that we got and set up and started to operate, they did really well. And then it was just a natural progression that, you know, we would do a third one, a fourth one. And then once you start to set them up, then you start to think about all of the other elements of the business, which is, well, how do you actually do it without burning yourself out? How do you create systems, processes? How do you hire staff? And, you know, one of the things, for example, in my line of work is we've always been used to remote work and kind of doing things in a spread out fashion. So we also applied it to the short term rentals as well. So now we have a team, for example, that manages both the Lumen Nature Retreat and the portfolio of the short term rentals that we have, and that entire team is remote.
Yeah, and I have to say that, like, I'm coming from the marketing background, so my nature is how can we automate things using the technology and software. So as our portfolio growing, before Lumen, we were thinking like, how can we like make everything so efficient through the technologies existing on the market? How can we like use our team to make sure that everybody is contributing and participating in everything?
Yeah.
Well, I think we, with our traditional Airbnb short-term rental portfolio growing, it actually set up a very good foundation for us to get
Right. Because I feel like what happens to a lot of people is they'll start with one and they'll be like, oh, I'm making some profit, so maybe I should like invest it in another one and we could make even more. And then they have a second one and a third one. And I feel like it's right around there where it's like you can kind of muscle your way through with two or maybe even three manually doing all the messages. Like, it's a lot of work, but you could do it. But once you hit that tipping point, it's like, all right, we got to do something to make this streamlined, to guarantee consistency, to guarantee good reviews, and to guarantee that you're continuing to profit off of them. But you all, because you have that background, I feel like probably hit that point a little bit earlier, knowing what you would need to do.
Yeah, but I would say that one of the great things about the short-term rental industry and the hospitality industry today is that there is access to a lot of phenomenal tools that can automate, you know, easily 80% of the day-to-day operations for really pennies. You know, whether it's a messaging app that can kind of do most of the regular messages to the guests, as well as even kind of effectively AI-based responses to the guests' questions, to pricing apps, to you know, all kinds of things, and that scale, that can scale tremendously as well.
Yeah, I hear that. And then I also, the part of me that like got into this space because I love hospitality is like, I need the automation to make sure everyone has a good experience, but then I want the human touch point to make it exceptional. And you actually mentioned Unreasonable Hospitality, and that book like changed my whole, like, I thought I was a good host before, and then I read that book and I was like, oh my gosh, there's so many missed opportunities here. So how do you balance this like knowledge of automation and what it can do to enhance experience while also Unreasonable Hospitality on the other hand of like going above and beyond on a personal level for every guest? How do you all manage that?
I think it's somewhat simple. We use automation wherever, for effectively the baseline or baseline situations. So again, check-in instructions, check-out instructions, common questions, all of this, it doesn't really need to be customized. This is something that should be standard that goes out to everybody, and automation will do it best. However, whenever guests have issues, whenever they have special occasions, this is where we see an opportunity to shine, and this is what we oftentimes talk with our team about as well. For example, at Lumen, we host a lot of elopements on a regular basis because a lot of couples basically decide to come out and do a photo session. And so, you know, something like that is a perfect opportunity to do a personal touch with potentially a gift basket and a custom postcard and a custom message, things of that sort.
Yeah. And another thing I think is important is, like, I think it's a concept that not only the owners should be aware of, like, we should actually make sure that every single of a team member, no matter is the like housekeepers or maintenance crew or anybody like guest coordinators, anybody working on the team, they're aware that the guest satisfaction is actually the highest priority among any other things we care about.
How do you all manage that, like, with a team of folks working on different properties? What do you have, like, an onboarding or training? I think a lot of folks that I talk to are still very small and so don't have to think about that yet or haven't thought about it yet. So how do you, what are some systems, internal systems that you would recommend for folks who might have multiple properties or looking to have multiple?
Yeah, so for us, just to give a little context, we have a remote team of five people with a chief operating officer kind of at the head of it all and four individuals working under him. This allows us to have coverage from early morning until late at night every single day for guest messages, for maintenance coordination, for anything that comes up. Plus, of course, we have at Lumen, we have a full-time on-the-ground team. For the other properties, of course, every property requires a staff as well. However, for the remote team, that is usually the first point of contact with the guests, we usually hire folks that don't have a background in hospitality, and we typically have about a 2-month training process that we'll take them through, and we'll train them not just on the day-to-day operations, but also kind of on our culture and our mindset and how we want to treat guests, how we want to treat our team members. And that's been really effective at making sure that we have a consistent experience.
Yeah, and another thing I want to add is, like, I think I wanted to mention that actually Slack is a game changer for our operation system. So I think a lot of the like owners of one house or two house, you probably can't, like, reach out or communicate with your ground crew through, like, text message or WhatsApp. That's exactly what we did in the beginning.
Yeah.
But after we evolve a little bit, we actually switch to Slack. So every single person on the ground or remote are all connected through Slack. So we have the whole visibility of everything happening in all properties at any moment. And a lot of automation we can actually integrate into Slack that actually make the whole business very, very transparent.
Yeah.
I think that is a game changer for us for the operational perspective.
Yeah, I would say that Slack for communication, Asana for keeping track of all of the action items that you have to do, a myriad of, you know, different tasks from the maintenance perspective and so on, as well as a tool that we call Notion, which is effectively an internal wiki for our entire team. So the combination of these three is what we use in every single day.
Yeah. I'm just starting to use Notion in my video business for start to finish tracking of all of our projects and all of the creative briefs and, like, touchstone. And it does remind me a lot of wikis. Just I feel like their user interface needs a little bit of work. It feels a little bit old school to me, but wiki, I haven't heard anyone say that in so long. And that's exactly what it feels like to me.
Yeah. I think it's important because, like, with managing properties, you have so many people. They are all, like, some are working on the ground, some are, like, remote. But I think it's very important to bring everybody on the same page, which is very hard if you don't have these helps of these tools.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe if you're only one property, you don't need it. But as you are growing, you definitely need some technology to help you to keep track of everything.
Right. I always think about culture. someone, I used to work in schools, and someone at a school who had the best school culture I've ever seen in my life said he thinks of it like gardening. And it's like, you have to plant the seeds at the beginning, but you have to like not only water them along the way and add fertilizer and make sure they have proper sunlight, but you also have to weed them. So sometimes it's taking away the things that are not working or getting in the way of that culture, which I think about all the time. And like same in Good to Great, they're like, you have to get the wrong people off the bus, right? Like the right people on the bus, the wrong people off, and then you can figure out where everyone goes. Okay, but this weeding, this getting people off the bus is really hard for a lot of us. What have you done when you've encountered, and I'm asking you because we haven't talked to many people with large teams, and that's when it starts to pop up. But like, can you give us an example of when something happened that wasn't a cultural fit and you had to address that by getting rid of a team member? Or like, what does that look like for folks who feel very uncomfortable and so might be letting a cleaner hang on a little too long, even though it's actually killing the consistency of their brand? What would you say to them?
Yeah, and I think we're certainly not immune to that, especially in the early days it would happen, both, as you mentioned, with the cleaning crew every once in a while, and sometimes even perhaps with a remote team member as well. One of the things that we've learned is that if we end up thinking about a particular team member late at night or discussing them late at night or kind of just they keep coming back again and again, it's basically the subconscious saying that something is just not quite right. And what we've ultimately learned, and I think what most business owners over time understand, is that you should hire slowly but fire quickly. So basically, if somebody is not a right fit, you would be doing them and yourself a favor by being more decisive about it and making that decision sooner than later. And again, of course, you need to do it in a humane way that that is respectful. But ultimately, every time that we've parted ways with somebody that we just didn't have the right feeling about, it ended up being ultimately a good thing.
And it feels like there were always signs that were showing up much earlier. I am totally guilty of firing way too slowly or not firing at all. And just like persistence, I can win them over. I can figure this out. We can work through this. But then you end up almost every time you have that feeling, it ends up not working out. And then you're like, well, what did I waste those 6 months for? Why did we spend 8 months trying to do this? And then usually the next time, like right now, my cleaner at one of the cabins is just amazing, has absolutely game changed everything. And it's like, why did I wait so long to make that switch, right? It was like way too long.
Yeah. And I think also we're very lucky because, right now, most of our staff is phenomenal. And we, even in our early days, we've been incredibly lucky with hiring some fantastic housekeepers, handymen, remote team members. So we have an idea of what a good relationship should be like.
Yes.
To use as a barometer, effectively.
That is such a good point.
It's not easy because we ourselves, even we have gone through so much, we still actually like sometimes takes too long to actually find somebody, which end up to be not very good for the whole business.
Yeah. I think that's also what's helpful in kind of clarifying what you want that culture and vision to look like is having like a clear brand and brand message and what that's about. And you can tell, I mean, I now know digging into your background a little bit why it's so clear, but I could tell from the first time I looked at your Instagram page that there was clear brand consistency there. Can you talk to me about in the early days, what kind of conversations you had that got you to a place where you were both together and then able to create a team that was really clear on what your brand message was?
So maybe I'll talk a little bit about kind of our journey to Lumen, and then perhaps Susan could talk about the brand itself as well. So again, we've been extremely lucky in a sense that before we even opened Lumen or before we purchased the land that is now Lumen, we've already had close to 10 Airbnbs in different parts of the country, understand what kind of a service we want to provide to our guests, have already a team in place or a core team in place. And then, but again, most of the other Airbnbs that we had were smaller, effectively traditional vacation rentals. And then back in 20, we've stumbled across, let me take a step back actually. We were looking for a project where we could in fact build kind of a larger outdoor focused hospitality brand. But we've come across this particular piece of land in the White Mountains of New Hampshire that we fell in love with. and we're able to purchase it. Even before we closed on it, we started to think about what that brand would ultimately be like and what it would look like.
Mm. Yeah, so I think a lot of the branding idea from Luma was like from our trip back in 2018 mm-hmm. when we were in South America. So I think one of my most memorable moments was when we were in like a national park in Peru. It's just like 5,000 feet like altitude, very like there's nobody around. We just camped there for the night. And in the middle of the night when I came out, like just to check out the surroundings, I saw this huge like Milky Way above us. Mm. It's just incredible. Like it's a huge like Milky Way, and underneath it, it's just our little car and our little tent on top of it. So this image just stuck with me. So when we were thinking about building something outdoor in the middle of the White Mountains, my immediate reaction is I wanted to be something associated with light. So to envision this little camp light in the middle of nowhere in the nature, just something like related to that. So we came across, we brainstormed a lot of ideas, and then this word lumen came to us.
Yeah.
Because association with lighting and association with like illumination and yeah. all these like positive things. So we decided on a brand idea, and then after that we were like evolving the brand based on that. So I think the core of Luma is really about to have people to be connected with nature and in a very comfortable way. You don't have to set up a tent yourself, but you can be in the nature while having
right.
everything in your bedroom. So that's the original thought of it. And another thought I think very important for us with Lumen is I think you don't have to get a lot of happiness through a lot of things in your life. So just like when we were on a trip in South America, all we have is a tent and a car. But we were very happy at the time. So I think the brand idea with Lumen was also like associated with that. Like a lot of things in your life can bring happiness. It's not like material goods, but like the time you spend with your loved ones and or like spending time under the starry sky next to the fire pit. Just little things like
yes.
that. So I think that's a core behind the Lumen brand.
Yeah. And actually removing a lot of things can provide more value to what you're talking about, connecting to each other, connecting to nature, being in a glamping exactly. tent versus a super fancy cabin that has everything you could possibly want. But does that actually change the experience because you have everything that you want?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It sounds like you had, I'm always curious which came first, the land or the idea and vision. So were you trying to find a piece of land that matched this vision of Lumen Camps? It sounds like, though, you might have found a piece of land and then that inspired the vision for what you're going to create.
Yeah, I would agree with that because I feel like every land is different. Like the same Lumen works in the middle of White Mountains, but might not work in the like in Texas or somewhere
yes.
else. So I think what you will build is really depending on the landscape and also the environment and the culture of that area.
Yeah. So take me back to your search for land. You must have known you wanted to create something if you were even looking for land. What did it start with?
Yeah. So once we had a bit of success with the traditional Airbnbs, vacation rentals, we wanted to do a larger project. We wanted to do it, again, with a focus on the outdoors because we both really enjoy it. So and so an opportunity in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, in fact, looking at campgrounds in particular because we thought that a campground would provide a good entry point where, it potentially already had some infrastructure in place, and B, it potentially would have already had some zoning in place as well
yeah.
that would be conducive towards hospitality.
Yeah.
We were generally looking for different options, and just one night, this particular family-owned campground came up for sale. And I think that I still remember the day that I showed it to Susan, and almost right away we knew that it couldn't be perfect. Part of it is because it was surrounded by water on three sides, which gave it a really special, unique feel. Part of it was that it had about 35 sites at that time, which was just right. It's big enough that would allow us some economies of scale and to be able to operate it effectively, but much smaller than some of the larger 100 to 200 site parks, campgrounds, where you may sometimes feel like you're in a parking lot sort of thing.
I've been to some of those before.
And it was just really a great location, great aesthetics, beautiful views, and a price point that we could afford. I think that one was
that's important.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we came out, met the owners, and within a few days put in an offer and were able to eventually acquire the campground.
But then what was the stage of development? Like, what was there currently? And then what have you created since? And what are you still planning to create on that land?
Yeah, so we broke it up into three different phases, and we've completed them, I would say, over 3 years. When we acquired it, it was very rustic. It just had an office, a bathhouse with showers and toilets and such, and about 35 rustic sites, basically meaning beautiful views, most of them either on the river or the pond, yeah. But no real facilities.
Yeah, no electric or no water.
Yeah. This sounds like most of the campgrounds that I grew up going to, with like the shared bathhouse. You'd check in at the office and then go to your site where you just had like a fire pit and that was it.
Yeah, that's exactly like that family owned that campground for 40 years. It's been like in the family for 40 years and it has been running like the same way since then. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first phase of our development was basically to test the waters and see if we can resonate with guests in terms of our brand and if we can also operate effectively. So the first phase was we purchased about 15 tent structures from Europe, different tent structures that Susan can talk about in a moment, and set them up and created the Lumen brand.
We also renovated the bathhouse.
That's right.
Yeah, because we wanted to make sure that people don't have a like traditional campground experience instead of like more elevated experience when they go to the bathhouse.
Okay, and I feel like people need to go to your website and see this because your bathhouse is nothing like any bathhouse I have ever seen at a campground that I grew up going to. And I feel like it does really set the tone for what you're creating, right? In terms of brand consistency, it's like if you stay in this beautiful glamping tent and then you go to the bathroom and it's just like, oh, they haven't put much thought into this. That changes everything for you.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It's interesting about the bathhouse too. You know, one of the concerns in the beginning was would people feel comfortable with shared facilities like this? But the truth is, if done right, you know, the majority of our guests are perfectly fine with it. And in fact, a lot of the times we hear a sentiment that when guests kind of go. When they arrive to Lumen, and they oftentimes come with their friends or family, and then when they will, let's say, walk to the bathhouse, they will say that it kind of reminds them of their younger days when,
they go take shower together.
Well,
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's fun.
So that was the first year we saw that there is demand. We saw that.
How quickly did you see the demand? You launch this, you do the renovations, you launch it. Was it like immediate full occupancy or was it like slow word of mouth spread?
Pretty much immediate because we're launching in July. So it's really the peak season for Bostonians to go to the White Mountains.
Yeah.
So we launched on July 1st. And then I think July we were like 80, 90% occupied.
And did you launch it on Airbnb? Did you go straight to direct booking? How did you manage that?
We did both in the very beginning. So we launched our website right before we actually launched the site. And then meanwhile, we also promoted on Airbnb as well. So in the beginning, I think like probably 70% of our bookings were from Airbnb, 30% from direct site. But it's definitely like becoming opposite after.
Oh, I'm sure. Because repeat guests who come, even if they're in like the entry level one, and then all of a sudden there's cabins and they're like, well, next time we want to try this. Great. I can see there's enough diversity that you don't feel like you're going to the exact same cabin every time, but you know exactly what to expect when you go.
Yeah. We already see a lot of repeating customers in the past couple of years. People just come different seasons, try different facilities. Yeah.
And I think the first year also kind of made us realize that to do this right, we do have to invest more into a marketing strategy and into building up the brand and really building up the direct booking pipeline as well. we love Airbnb, we love the OTAs, but again, for a small brand, you have to do direct as well. So that brought us to the second year, which was 2020. At that particular time, we've added about 20 micro cabins on wheels, and that basically filled up the remaining space. So now we had about 35 different units. We had a really great mix of cabins, larger safari tents that would be very suitable for families, for larger groups, and these very romantic, I would say, A-frame tents.
Yeah. I think thinking back, I think one decision we made it right is to actually have a variety of different structures. Because in the beginning, we were debating a lot, like, are we going to just do cabins or are we just going to do one type of tents? But we do say after we made the decision that we're going to try different variety of structures, we do see that people actually prefer this. It adds more variety to the land and people can try different structures as well, which they love.
It also feels like it gives different access points for someone who might not be able to afford $400 a night for a nice cabin, but they might be able to afford a tent. And then over time, maybe in 5 years, they will be able to, right? But it allows everyone to kind of experience that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But it does add a challenge for you all in terms of pricing, not only seasonal shifts, because I know in the White Mountains, similar to Maine, there's like, you know, pretty distinct seasons, but also just in different structures. Do you do that pricing yourself? What tools do you use to manage pricing and manage occupancy?
So for pricing, we do use a tool called Price Labs to some degree. But I would say that for Lumen, especially during the first couple of years, and it may change later on, we effectively develop our own pricing strategy and we do tweaks to it every single week. Basically, as with any hospitality operator, you're looking to find the right mix of occupancy and average daily rates. And now that we've been operating for 2 years, we have a better idea of what's in demand, what are the low seasons. But again, we tweak prices all the time. And this is something that we discuss internally, I would say almost on a weekly basis as well.
Yeah.
So that's why there is a big delta. During the off season, on a weekday, you can get one of our accommodations for maybe $100 a night. During the peak season, on a weekend, as you said, it may be as much as $400 a night.
Right. And paying attention to that. I also still do mine manually and have considered Price Labs. I tried the automatic pricing with Airbnb and hated it. I just thought their numbers were so off. So then I've just done it manually every year. And it's why we only open our calendar because we only have one cabin. This is specifically for Cozy Rock. Open it every season. And I literally have a spreadsheet where I'm like, here's what my prices were. Here's how many nights until we hit full occupancy. And like, if there's a line or it happens too quickly, then my prices are too low. So then next year I'll look back at that season. It's like very old school. So I feel like I should try Price Labs. But to hear you say you do it manually, that's still what I do for a lot of it.
I think we use Price Lab majority on our traditional Airbnbs because Price Lab does have a huge value in comparing the similar like rentals in the area that you can, they can give you pricing suggestions. But it doesn't really work for Lumen or probably your cabin, which is you probably only have one property and then in the area.
Yeah.
So I think like Price Lab is valuable, but not for this sort of.
Yeah. And I find it struggles more with unique properties that it'll try to compare like, oh, we have technically one bedroom. So I'm going to compare it with other one bedroom, one bath rentals in this area. And it's like, okay, but this one was designed very intentionally. Or if anything is different about it, it's just looking at that data, which makes sense to me, but it does make it feel like it's not as accurate in terms of what you could get for it and what maybe you should be getting for it.
100%. If you're a Holiday Inn, then basically every room that you have is effectively a commodity. And you're driven a lot by what are the other mid-level hotels in the area going to be charging.
Right.
But for something that's more unique is different. And also a lot of it depends on what your brand is, and how strong your brand is.
Yeah, which brings me to Instagram because I feel like just recently I've had a bunch of conversations in DMs with folks who might have one cabin now and have done really well on Instagram and are now adding a second and are wondering, I've heard a lot of this conversation of like, should I have a second Instagram for it or should I have the same one for all of them. Now, you all have a lot of different properties, so Lumen Camps makes sense that it's only one. But yet, it is so consistent. When I look at your Instagram, it creates a very consistent like expectation of what a stay there might be like. What are your thoughts on the marketing side for someone who might only have one or two properties? Should they start thinking as a holistic brand and brand them all together, or should they brand each one separately and have separate Instagram accounts for that? Do you have any expert advice on this?
I think, to be honest, we're very new to Instagram. We really started using Instagram when we started setting up Lumen. We're still learning all of this.
Yeah.
But from my own personal perspective, I think probably one is better than multiple because you really have very limited energy and the resources.
Yes.
In terms of content creation and like working with influencers. So I think it's probably better to starting with one and really build up that brand follower base on Instagram.
Yeah.
Once you reach to a certain threshold, probably like after you have 100,000 followers or something, or 10,000 followers, whatever number you decided, you can start thinking, how can you like drive some of the traffic to a new brand?
Yeah.
But because we actually work with some professionals on Instagram as well, we know that it's a lot of work to put into good content and a lot of money.
Yes. That was going to be my question of how you approach that, because you've used a lot of different cabin photographers, many of which we've used too. How do you approach that strategy? Is that led by you, or do you have a marketing team who's like researching those and figuring out how often you have them come?
Yeah, so actually it's just for the marketing team, it's just me and what we have a social media system.
So you're the one we want to talk to.
So to be honest, I learned all the Instagram tricks by some bigger accounts. Like for example, very popular one, Live Oak Lake. I really literally went through their Instagram account.
Wait, which one is this?
There's a cabin owner called a cabin called Live Oak Lake. So they are based in Texas.
Okay.
And they grew so super like quick. So they grew like from like 1,000 followers to 100,000 followers in 1 year on their social media, on particular Instagram. So I literally went into their social media account and analyzed each single of their posts and see what type of posts actually give them the most.
Yeah. So what were your takeaways? What advice do you have for other folks who are trying to grow?
There's a lot of very interesting find. So before we heard a lot about working with influencers, but what does it really mean? Who to work with? Or would you give influencers in exchange for these things? So what we found out is, or what I found out that is, influence, there are two types. There are content creators. So basically, these are the photographers that will give you very good content that you can use for your social media account. But there's also another type. What we found is most effective influencers are actually those like foodies or like lifestyle influencers in your area, particularly if you are in New Hampshire or in Maine. If you can find a foodie, foodie account in New Hampshire or foodie account in Maine, similar accounts like that. You just work with them and do probably one very effective strategy is do a giveaway. So in this way, it's actually a very effective way to grow accounts and grow audience for both sides. And you don't have to pay a huge amount. So
I find it interesting that you mentioned specifically foodies, because I would always think to look in the hospitality, like the lifestyle one makes sense to me because it just kind of encompasses everything. But it's interesting that you specifically said foodies were effective.
It's interesting. We found out that too. Like we work with a lot of lifestyle influencers. They're great. They create great content, but their audience are probably like more people like operators or like people owning the cabins who wanted to learn from other cabins, but not really your target audience.
Yes.
But who are your target audience are people who live in the area looking for fun things to do in New Hampshire, Maine, which they are the audience for the foodie accounts. I find a lot of like foodie account in like New England, but there are a few of them. Some are good, some are not. But if you can find a few of them in your area, that can be a very effective way to grow your audience. That's just my like a very.
No, that's like, super fascinating. No one has ever said that before. Do you have any particular photographer or influencer you want to shout out that you really enjoyed working with?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So in New Hampshire, we work a lot with a photographer called Will. Sorry, I can't forgot
his last name. I always forget names when I know Instagram accounts. I always forget the names behind
them. Exactly. Yes. I know the Instagram handle, yes. But I...
Yes.
Yeah, but he helped us doing a lot of amazing content. And also we work with a lot of the very popular cabin influencers on Instagram, like Dirt and Glass mm-hmm. and... similar to that.
Yeah.
So every one of them are great. They are super great content creators, but just like you work with different creators in different ways. Some you wanted to get new content. Some you wanted to grow your audience.
That's right. That's right. And as someone, for me, you live a bit closer to your, I live pretty far from Maine. So for me, it's just a matter of like, oh, I can't get content all the time. And so having people come, even if they're not like promoting it to their audiences, but just giving me content that I can use in reels or posts or carousels or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, we also have a like page on our website, basically, if anybody wanted to work with us, collaborate with us to exchange a stay with free content, we always welcome.
That's a good idea to put something on your website. I've never done that before because I don't often say no. If someone reaches out to trade a free stay and they have nice content, if we have open weekdays somewhere, like I'm usually happy to do it.
Yeah,
but I don't give a place for them to sign up. That's a really good idea.
Yeah, just give us a more like systematic way that we can actually filter out the good content creators versus mediocre ones. Yeah.
You're so strategic and organized about this. I feel like so much of what I figured out has just been like along the way, like, oh, this is overwhelming. I need to solve that problem. So I'll do this. But it feels like you have like quite the back end operations making this whole thing run.
But I'm pretty sure there are so much things to learn about Instagram marketing. We're probably just
early on.
Yeah, very early on stage, just trying
Well, and it changes so often, right? That's also the tricky part. Yeah. And I think kind of makes it fun, but it's just, it's changing all the time. Not even just Instagram, but also, oh, there's another platform, TikTok, whatever else you could be using to market, and figuring out where you want to spend your energy, for me, feels a little bit overwhelming. Okay, so do you all do any of the hosting? Do you have someone who manages like the guest experience side of it, who's in charge of the like unreasonable hospitality? If you hear about an occasion that someone's celebrating that you do things, is that systematized or is that more like one-off? Someone is just in charge of coming up with those things?
No, it's systematized as well to a degree. So for example, across all of our properties, our guest service coordinators who are kind of our remote team members, they have a budget every year, let's say it's $1,000 or whatever the amount may be, that they're authorized to use to create wow experiences for the guests. So we've done that before. And basically, whenever they see that a guest is writing in saying that they're coming to town for X, Y, or Z, which sounds like an opportunity to delight them, you know, we'll do that.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, I mean,
For example, like one of our property has there is a group of guests coming for a bachelorette party. So our guest coordinator actually pre-order like champagne bottles, champagne cups with like those customized bachelorette signs and also cupcakes and the champagnes, just to set up the tone for the before the party arrives.
From the minute that they arrive.
Yeah, small things like that.
Yeah, we ship out a lot of there's a great bakery in Boston that makes cupcakes, and we ship out a lot of basically fresh cupcakes because they do overnight delivery as well.
Oh, wow, so that's so nice.
Yeah. On the ground as well, for a lot of our properties, when we know that somebody's having an event, we'll provide them with a bottle of wine and things of that sort. And then at Lumen in particular, we also have kind of a celebration package that's a little bit more systematized. So basically, if guests know that they're coming in to celebrate an anniversary or something of that sort, they can pre-order a celebration package. And occasionally, we'll do something just on the house as well. Again, if we see an opportunity to delight. And in terms of who's in charge of that, well, there is a process that's present across the board. So again, the guest service coordinators, they may have a budget to treat guests when they think it's applicable. The housekeepers, they may know that before, something to that effect. And
or something like exceptional that not usual, that the coordinator will just post on Slack. And so we can all participate and see what ideas we want to actually I guess.
Yeah. I will say that's one thing I've struggled with since reading Unreasonable Hospitality, and is like wanting to do more of that and trying to figure out how I learn the details of the people to do something that is truly unique to them. Because we have like champagne bottles that we'll put in the fridge for a holiday or something like that. But like just recently there's one, I hope she doesn't listen to the podcast, but she's coming and she like divulged on Instagram that she booked it for herself because she's going through a breakup. And so I was in town a couple of weeks ago. And so it's so rare that I have that piece of information about someone, but I was like, okay. So I went and like got my favorite book that like helped me when I was going through a breakup and got like a candle, like, and got to put together like a special gift bag for her. But what it made me realize, I found so much joy in doing that. But how do you find out like what someone is struggling with or what they're celebrating or like what they need to really truly make it like unreasonable and not just kind of the standard thing you do for everyone? It's really hard to like figure out how you get to know them.
I think it's not easy, but definitely I think it's all about like for us, it's about how we train our coordinators to make sure that they sometimes talk to our guests in a personalized way to try to know them a little bit more besides the standard like check-in information. So we get a lot of information from our guest coordinators.
We do host a good amount of guests every year. So generally speaking, people do disclose that they're coming to town because of, you know, something specific.
Yeah.
They will usually highlight it.
So. I've started asking now, just as at least the very minimum in our first automated message, which is automated. It says like, if you're coming to town for something in particular, like, please let us know. We're happy to help when we can. And I've gotten a couple people share things there, but it's still more general high level. The highest yielding ones have been relationships on Instagram. And I've started following guests back, which I hadn't done initially. So I was like, I was worried they were going to think it was creepy. But now it's like, well, you follow me and I put a lot of stuff on our Instagram. So I'm going to follow you. And that has led to like real human relationships. So then when there's repeat guests, you know more about them because you've been following them on Instagram for a year. And I'm hoping that that will yield more touch points to do truly unreasonable things. And I do feel like you can't do it for everyone. You can't go above and beyond for every guest. So it's really just figuring out where and when you can, and it makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Especially when you have more guests, how to scale.
I think it's a good point. If you're a host and have a couple of properties, you know, you're bound to have one approach. If you are operating as a larger kind of entity and you may have, say, 100 rooms or 10 properties, however many guests you host per year, it's almost inevitable that you're going to create systems and standardize
them. You have to.
But I think, as Susan pointed out, the biggest thing that you can do is give autonomy to the people on your team that interact with the guests to make the decisions on the fly, and ideally a budget as well. And just let them make the decisions.
Yeah. When I heard you say you gave them a budget, I was like, this is a really good idea. And it almost makes me wonder, because our cleaner at Cozy Rock is so much more than just a housekeeper. Like, she loves the guest experience part of it. And I wonder if I gave her a budget per month or whatever to just occasionally go above and beyond, I wonder what she would do with it. And I, in not giving that to her, have no idea how creative she might get. And how much more she might like her job then too, right? If she gets to create those moments rather than just execute whatever I tell her to do every time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So interesting. Okay, I'm going to end with our last question, which is always the same. And that is, what do you think, there's a lot of debate about this, what makes a cabin versus a house or something else? What do you think really distinguishes a cabin from other places?
So I can talk about that a little bit. So for us, the cabins that we have, they follow effectively this Danish concept of hygge. And the hygge refers to this sense of coziness and contentment and peacefulness. And I think that that's something that's really present with, you know, with a lot of cabins, really across the board, is that it's a standalone structure, oftentimes in the outdoors, well, predominantly in the outdoors, I would say, that has everything that you need, but nothing that you don't. And a lot of, I think, of what happens in cabins is that people come there to perhaps create memories.
Yeah.
And that's what we see all the time as well. And You know, for us, we look at cabins as kind of these bedroom in nature, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of our guests, they will come to escape the hustle and bustle of the city, to spend time with their loved ones, to have conversations and kind of lose the distractions that come with, you know, the phones and the jobs and all of this. That's and I think that that's what makes a cabin a cabin.
I love that. Everything you need, but nothing that you don't. That is going to be my biggest takeaway, I think, from this episode. I love that so much. What about you, Susan? What would you say?
I think it's pretty much echoes what Boris said. Yeah. Basically, cabin has to be connected with nature and has to bring a lot of memories for people staying there, yeah, and have coziness and like quality time with each other. Yeah. I think that's the most important for, yeah, cabin time.
I love that. You guys, thank you so much for joining me.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Really enjoyed hearing about what you all are creating up north, not that far from Maine. Thanks so much for joining us. And if you liked what you heard, feel free to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or share some of your favorite parts over on Apple Podcast. If you have feedback or suggestions for the future, you can also find me on Instagram @CozyRockCabin. Looking forward to next week.